Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, owner of the company Horns of Odin. As always, before we get into the show, I do have to do a little bit of housekeeping because it's how we keep the lights on. So if you are able to jump over to our Patreon, it's just patreon.com/ Nordic Mythology Podcast. From £3 a month, you can get a bonus episode every single week. And that is usually a Q&A episode we do with the guest right after the main show. You can submit your questions in lifetime through the live chat or ahead of time through the Patreon. You also get ad-free episodes, early access to all the episodes. You can watch them live like I just mentioned, and you also get access to our Discord server, which is a lovely little community that we've built over the years. We're also going to be adding a story time episode to that tier as well. That's something we're going to be doing in the new year. We're going to do a whole shake up and add a bunch of new things. So jump on now and check out all the old stuff that's available on there. And if you aren't able to support us financially, I guess through the Patreon, another way is just to like and share our things on social media, drop us a comment, just let people know about the podcast. It helps new people, listeners, find the podcast and just helps us keep growing and going in the right direction. And that's just Nordic Mythology Podcast across all the different channels. But today I have a very special guest. He is a behind the scenes worker on the podcast, as well as his own little intellectual, scholarly mastermind. You're a PhD candidate right now, Bob?
Yes.
So it is Bob van Strien. He's got to correct me on the pronunciation because my mouth doesn't make the little noise that his does. So, Bob, do you want to clean your name up, I guess?
Yeah, so my name is Bob van Strien. Strien is actually a small village in the Netherlands.
Do you own the village?
I mean, not me.
At some point.
But perhaps one of my ancestors somewhere down the line. There's also a castle, Van Strien, which is in Oosterhout, which is not around the corner exactly. But, well, I say a castle. It's the ruin. It's basically one corner of a tower of 6 stories high.
Did you stake claim to it?
I mean, I'd wish, but... I don't think that's possible. But who knows? Hey, maybe if my career picks off and...
Hopefully. Limit. One day.
The money you make with academia, it's insane. So.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I think we spoke about that with Howard last week. So I have to admit, your topic, I read the sentence, and it baffled me more than I would like to admit. So I actually am looking forward to this just so you can clean up what we're going to actually talk about, I guess. So I guess that I'm going to guess you wrote this, and
there's a chance.
So it's the studying the post-war correspondence between two scholars involved with, who happened to be involved with National Socialism in the field of Old Norse philology?
Yes.
Okay. To me, that's going to take some explaining, I think.
Right. Let's start, I guess, with philology.
Yeah. Okay.
So just the word itself, from Greek philos logos, which I think roughly the love of words.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, philologists deal with text. And okay. Then there's two branches within that. Some are kind of more linguists. They take a very strict, you look at the text and what it means kind of thing. And others take a more wide approach, which basically makes it the same as history, the study of history. I think you look at text, you look at their context, try and see what they mean. So historically, philology has been used very widely. And so one of the scholars we'll talk about would be a philologist, but he became a scholar of religion as well.
Okay.
You know, back in the day, even before then, you know, people in academia would be basically anything. You could sit in your bathtub and write a history of everything, and also, you know, natural sciences and be an alchemist on the side. So it's been narrowed down quite a bit since then.
Is philology an oldie worldy word, or does it still get used a lot today if there isn't much difference, I guess?
I don't think that in daily speech it's used a lot, but in academia, I suppose it is. I mean, my position is in Old Norse and Celtic philology.
Okay.
I
guess it's just with you saying there's not much difference with, like, I guess, an historian.
No.
I just wondered at what point somebody would be a philologist and versus an historian, or is it just maybe when somebody likes to use a, you know, we all do it, like a nice word for what we do to make ourselves, not make ourselves sound special, but...
Honestly, I'm not quite sure. My project could have been in the history department, could have been in the study of religion department, could have been in the history of science department, which is nice in a way that it's you know, I could place it in a lot of departments, a lot of universities, if they wanted me. But also it's such a narrow piece of history, I guess, that nobody really would be interested. So for example, in the history of science, my project is interesting because I look at the work of two scholars in their field. But in the great scheme of things, who cares about these two guys 70 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't blame them for not accepting me into that program. And then in the study of religion, you know, Germanic, Old Norse, whatever you want to call it, religion is such a tiny, tiny bit of all the religions that are out there, both past and present. So again, if they wouldn't accept this project in the Department of Religion, that's fair enough. Mm-hmm. But I'm happy that they accepted me in Old Norse philology here in Oslo, where I already lived. So that was very lucky for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So did you pick this extremely niche topic, or was it one that was out there and you applied for the research onto this?
This is my project. So I wrote it with, you know, some help, some feedback here and there. But here in Oslo, most of the time the position is open, or there's one or two positions open. You apply with your own project. And So you pick your topic, you decide what to include and what to exclude to make sure it fits within the 3-year time scheme that you're supposed to deliver in. Make it relevant to the department and to current events, possibly, you know, sell yourself as a candidate.
I think then Jennifer in the chat had a perfect question, which is then, why do you care? Because clearly, I know you said, why would anyone care? But obviously there is something here. I've known you a little while now. I know you wouldn't be sticking your nose into something that wasn't interesting, and there's something there for people to learn from, I guess. So, yeah, why this?
All right, it's time for a history lesson of my own history.
Okay.
So,
does it involve castles?
Not necessarily. I can put a castle in there at some point.
Just throw it in there.
If we don't get sidetracked at some point. But so yeah, I did a bachelor's in Leiden in the Netherlands, a bachelor in religious studies or comparative religion, in which I focused on what I thought was Germanic religion, Germanic mythology. And so in my track, after the introductions from the first year, you had to specialize, and I did ancient religions as well as new religious movements. And then I wrote my bachelor thesis on Aristotelian Odinism and their connection to neo-Nazism. And then one of my professors told me, did you know that we used to have a professor of Germanic philology here in Leiden until they kicked him out because he was a Nazi? And we haven't had it in Leiden since. So someone should actually do a PhD about this and see if, you know, we know that he was a collaborator. You know, he will probably get into that later. He was a collaborator, but was his work good, or did his ideology get, you know, shoehorned in there somehow?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, someone should do a PhD on this. You could do a PhD on this. So I figured, you know, that's a pretty good idea.
I actually thought for a second then you were talking, saying I could do a PhD on this. I'm like, no, Bob. No,
couldn't. You could do my PhD for me.
I was like, you think you're really highly of me now.
I mean, you've learned stuff in the last, was it 3.5 years?
Yeah, I've forgotten a lot of stuff as well.
Yeah, so then I heard about this master's program in Iceland, or it's a collaboration between the University of Iceland, the University of Oslo, Aarhus University in Denmark, and also the University of Copenhagen. And so I went to Iceland for this 2-year program. And there I had a course by Terry Gunnell, who I'm paraphrasing here, but he basically said that we know that De Vries was a Nazi, but his work is still good.
Okay.
And also his main work, Altgermanische Religionsgeschichte.
What the? What is that? Somebody's name?
This is Altgermanische Religionsgeschichte. Is the history of the religion of the old Germanic peoples, roughly translated.
No, I really want to try and say that, but I know that there's no way that I could do that. Slow it down for me.
Altgermanische Religionsgeschichte.
Oh, I can't.
Let me type
it. I can't even begin where to start. You said like the first two syllables. I was like, okay, I could get in this. And then, no, I can't do it. There'll be so many German people who would just hate me. I'm assuming it's German.
It is German. But basically, it's old Germanic religious history.
Okay. You know what that looks like? Have you ever seen that Welsh train station? That's like that's what that looks like to me. Just a collection of vowels and consonants that I just don't even know where to start. And you know what's also alarming? That's only two words. So for anybody who can't see the chat, that's only two words. I thought it was going to be like a bunch of smaller ones that I could maybe try and break down.
Try a German sentence. They go on for pages.
Oh, really?
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah, but so I'll also address a question in the chat. It's not been translated to English, but it has been replaced more or less. So this one came out in the mid-50s. And what is it? I think in 2018, the first volume came out of what's supposed to be a 7-volume series on the pre-Christian religions of the North, which when they were compiling this, they referred to as the new De Vries, so the new this one. So it's sort of a replacement and or an addition to, because 70 years of scholarship, especially archaeology, has you know, found a lot of things. They dig up new stuff every day, basically. So it needed updating. So anyway, yeah. So Terry said that, you know, the relevance of the project might not be there to the point where you can convince a university to pay you to do this. So you might want to look for something else. Sorry, I was sidetracked for a little bit. I returned to Leiden, got a job at the university library, and got to talk to the special, or the subject librarian of the special collections. Now, it just so happens to be that in the Leiden University Library's special collections, they have the personal archive of this scholar, including journals from when he was in camp after the war, including an autobiography, and including a lot of correspondence with his family and with his colleagues. And I found some interesting stuff in there that made me think, you know what? I think there's actually a project here.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they knew that he was a collaborator to some extent, but they might not know how bad it probably was. And his work does seem to be more colored by his political ideas than people might think right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I got to, trying to figure out how to word this the right way and apply for various PhD positions. And then finally, what is it? Just over a year ago, I started here in Oslo, which is very nice.
So, do you have to word that quite delicately? Because I don't know, I feel like anything this day and age that contains anything to do with Nazis can be shut down pretty quickly. It's all very taboo. But but then again, I don't know if that's the same in academia or whether they just take that objective kind of standpoint on it.
I'd like to think that they're very objective.
Yeah.
You hear rumors every once in a while that someone at another university might be somewhat so then you're not sure. But I think, the project has to have merit in its own right. So it's not just this guy is a Nazi, we should get rid of him. There's correspondence that can tell us a lot about the development of Old Norse philology in the post-war decades.
I was more meaning when you have to present this idea to the university and ask for funding, do you have to kind of be quite delicate in that? Because I just wondered whether they would maybe avoid wanting to, not wanting to fund things that are linked to Nazis, or whether they would just maybe choose a different PhD for somebody else because it's not kind of centralized around that, even though the work you're doing is clearly beneficial, because there is a ton of work done by scholars who were Nazis, and it can't all be shit, I guess. You have to try and find what's good and what's not, and rather than just throwing it. We have a term in England, throw the baby out with the bathwater. Do you have that anywhere else? Do you know what that means?
Same in Dutch.
Yeah, okay.
And I keep reiterating that ideally we find that everything in this work is fine, or both the scholars I work on, but that, they were Nazis to some extent, or involved with the Nazi party to some extent, but their work is flawless, it's excellent, we can still use it. That would be wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that is the case, but it would be great if it is, because then we don't have to worry about anything. If I find that there are pieces in here that are ideological, then we need to find them and see how far they've traveled since. Mm-hmm. So I guess this is a good time to make it more concrete. There's one line in this letter between these two guys I study, where Jan de Vries, so the Dutch scholar from Leiden, wrote that he wanted to republish a book because it had been sold out, but it would have to be revised somewhat, if only to remove traces from its appearance in Hitler times.
Okay.
And this is roughly translated from the German, but that's what it says. It says Hitler times. Traces from its appearance in Hitler times. And it did come out. So the original is from 1943, this one. And then the revised edition is from 1964. And it is different. And part of my project is then to see what the differences are. So if I do it very old school, I could just go page by page, word for word, see exactly what the differences are. I'm hoping to do a faster way with scanning and text recognition and stuff. But so if we can find those traces of Hitler times, or let me start it over. It is very well possible that the changes in the book are because scholarship has developed in 20 years. So between 43 and 64, there's bound to be differences. That's fine. But we can probably see why there are those differences. And then hopefully we can see what are differences that aren't explainable by updated scholarship. And then can see if those are maybe traces of these Hitler times. And then if we have those traces, maybe we can find those traces in other publications as well, of which we don't have a revised edition, and see, hey, you know, actually this line here, that's very suspect. It's actually kind of Nazi, even though we didn't know at the time. And then we can try and do 70 years of cleaning up.
So would it not just be quicker to redo the research? And maybe that's my naivete. Of like, rather than looking at the work and trying to split out the Nazi from the work, see what's solid.
Right.
Would it be easier just to go, okay, well, scrap the book. We're going to get some people to just go back and look at the original stuff and put it in modern times. Does that make sense, or am I oversimplifying it? I know it would put you out of a PhD, and I'm sorry.
By the time you get this to them, I'm probably done, I hope. It's always good, you know, when you start new scholarship, for example, Old Norse mythology, Old Nordic mythology,
nice.
To go back to the crowd. Sources. Start at the sources. Always start at the sources. But you kind of have to acknowledge that other people have written about this as well and have thoughts about it as well. And so your interpretations are probably inspired by others.
Okay, yeah.
Even if you don't remember reading it or hearing it.
Yeah, I guess you have to have learned it from someone, because you're not going to only read the original sources, if right. Some of them even still exist.
Yeah. We all have our baggage in some way, and it doesn't really matter where you come from or why you're in this field or in this interest range. I've been wondering about it a lot, and I think for me it started with Vicky the Viking, the cartoon. Mm-hmm. Back when I was 5. Yeah. And then there was Lego with the was it Lionheart's castle or something. I actually bought it a few months ago. It's amazing. But so that's where my interest in the Middle Ages started, I think. But our depiction of the Middle Ages or of the Viking Age is of course very informed by other things. So you could imagine if there's a teenager right now who saw the Northmen from last year, they probably think that, okay, that is how Vikings looked.
Okay, yeah.
Right, or that is how Odin walked around, or how burial rituals were carried out with the mount and the Viking ship and the bloodbath and everything, which is based on scholarly studies. Mm-hmm. I think mainly Neil Price was involved in the burial ritual. I know Terry Gunnell was involved in this. Who else? Well, there are a few scholars who were involved in some way. And we'd like to think that their work is good, and therefore their influence on the movie was good, and therefore if kids see it now, then that's a good depiction. But there's a good chance that in 20 years we'll look back and say, well, that is actually not entirely how we think now that it should have looked. I feel like I got away from your question a bit, but
I feel like most teenagers will be learning what the Vikings looked like from Vikings, the TV show, or The Last Kingdom rather than the Northmen.
It's a good chance.
I think that's probably going to shape the next generation's image of Vikings.
Yeah, that's a good chance. And now we know that, you know, all the music sounds like Vardrina, and everyone had to side shave things and the and the braids. And the
head tattoos.
Oh, of course. And the cool leather patchwork stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The shaved head, the shaved size of the head and the tattoos is a wild one. That I think so many people, and I'm not against it, I know a lot of people who kind of have that look, and it is what it is. You know, it's whatever, people can do whatever the hell they want. It's not for me to judge. But I think there are a lot of people who got whipped up into a certain, I don't know if a frenzy is the right word, or like in super interest into this stuff from things like Vikings, the TV show, that got that look, who maybe might regret it in the future. You know, I saw a guy at Comic-Con the other week who had two, let's say, like Vikings TV show inspired like head tattoos either side, and they weren't the best. And I'm just like, that's all right now when you're in cosplay, but like in everyday life, like that's a big decision to make for something that we don't know if they even really had, but it's very much influenced by the popular image of what that looks like today.
I mean, to me, it never really matters if it's what they really had. I mean, if you want to walk around like that, that's fine. It's a shame if you do it because you think that they had that and you want to emulate that somehow.
Yeah. I think that's probably the case for a lot though, but you know, it is what it is. There's no,
I listened back to the previous episode, my previous episode, and we talk about the same kind of stuff actually, and I said it then as well, it what makes this difficult for me, like my studies sometimes clash with modern interpretations, including those by people that believe in this stuff, let's call it stuff. And if I can show from the sources that, you know, this is probably not how it looked, or how it was believed, or how it was carried out, or something, but actually it's like this, and that messes with their belief system that they might have been in for, if they're unlucky, 10, 20 years, then there's a disconnect there. And then I'm probably the bad guy for pointing out that historically this is wrong. You know, I don't care how people live their religions. I care about historical accuracy, if we can even find that. I know that's another debate, but it's weird to then navigate Instagram and say like, well, this is actually probably how it was, or this is probably wrong because of whatever reasons, or this we don't know, but we know that the guy was a Nazi. So do you really want to do what the Nazi said? If you could choose, I'd say don't do what the Nazi said. Unless what the Nazi said is objectively true, like in the case of archaeology, it's hard to debate an actual find can debate about the interpretation of the find.
So that's kind of a question that I have is, when it comes to work done by Nazis on this stuff, as you eloquently put it earlier, how much of it do you, because I feel like there must be, in my mind, there's two camps. There's one where it's a genuine, quote unquote, genuine Nazi who believes in all of that ideology, who then puts that into looking at Norse mythology as historically, and then to try and make them fit together. I don't know. Or you have the other side that is, it's just a genuine scholar who happens to live during the times of National Socialism, but then has to kind of add and sprinkle these little bits of the times in to then get their work past. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's those two camps, and I was interested in like where you think most of this leans.
Yeah, that's a very good question, a very thoughtful question.
I stole it from the chat. I can't even take full credit for it. I wish you could.
You asked the same question last time, so you already had it.
Okay.
But I didn't answer it the way I am going to answer it now. So that's, you know, something new. But it's something that I have to look into, because so in this correspondence, shall I tell a little bit more about that? It's 122 letters, I think, from 1945 till 1964. And it's pretty evenly spread out. And in it, they talk a lot about their work and their publications and their colleagues. And this is why it ties into the question. They mention a lot of colleagues, and some of them are Scandinavians, some of them are Germans or Austrians, and there's a few other nationalities as well. But especially with the Germans, you're like, okay, let me check if this guy is a Nazi. And lo and behold, most of them are at least a member of the Nazi party.
I feel like it's kind of hard to differentiate that, and probably hard for most people to differentiate that. Feel like there must have been levels to, I mean, there certainly were, but it's kind of like, as soon as, if you're a member of the Nazi party, it's automatic kind of death sentence or just hell of barrage. But there must have been people who just were forced to join, or were kind of a member, quote unquote, because they had no choice. And then obviously there are those who were very active in, you know, the beliefs and the acts that they, and the atrocities that they committed.
No, definitely. There were, after the war, I said it last time, they arrested everyone and their dad. Basically, the entire German workforce was arrested at some point because of collaboration. And that is not a very economic thing to do, because you would cripple the country and send it into bankruptcy, and mm-hmm. everyone would die. And they've learned from the first one that it's not a very good idea to completely destroy a country like that. So they needed to get at least a good portion of the workforce back. So they had a very quick trial most of the times, where they had about 5 stages of how much of a Nazi you were. So the first one is, you're innocent, you're not involved in any way. And then there's a bandwagoner called Mitlaufer, where basically if you didn't do anything drastic, but you were a party member after 1937, then you were a bandwagoner, because you had to join the party to function in daily life.
Okay.
And then the higher steps are various ways of war crimes, or, you know, executing the entire Holocaust, mm-hmm. and setting that into motion. So for most, or there's a good portion of the German population that was just a bandwagoner that just joined the party after 37 because they kind of had to. Mm-hmm. So yeah, for some of the names that I encounter in this correspondence, that is possibly the case. For Otto Hoeffler, not so much. Even though he was called a bandwagoner, it's a very interesting case. he was inspired by Hitler in like 1920 or 1921. He writes this in his CV, that he saw Hitler speak and it was grabbed by the charisma or something like that. And then he joined the Vienna Ordnertruppe, which is the precursor to the Sturmabteilung. So how does that translate? You know what the Sturmabteilung is? Does everyone know? It's, mm-hmm. I guess, like a sort of militia kind of group.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you. and then, what was it? In 1931, he went to Uppsala in Sweden as a lecturer. I might have the wrong date, but it was definitely before 1933. He was in Uppsala. Mm-hmm. And then in 1933, this is important, there was a membership stop for the Nazi Party because they had just got to power and everyone wanted to become a member. So it was too many and they had a membership stop until 1937. In 1934, Hoeffler first got to Germany. So at the time he got to Germany and was able to become a member of the party, he wasn't able to become a member of the party because there was a membership stop. But then when it opened again in 37, he did become a member. Right.
Okay, so he could he have not, or would it have had negative ramifications on like daily life if when it opened back up, he didn't join?
Sorry.
So obviously he couldn't join when he first went to mm-hmm. Germany, and then he joined obviously when, I guess, submissions or it started again in, you said, 37.
Yes.
In 37, is that like a very, or do we know, is that a strong, I want to join this party because I believe in it? Or is it that now that it's open again, I can join and it's going to have benefits for my everyday life to join? So it's kind of a flippant thing. Let's just get the... This sounds horrible to say, a flippant thing to get the Nazi card at the time, because it's going to just help me live my life. I don't really care.
And that's hard to say just on the fact that they joined.
Yeah.
That you can't really tell anything from that.
Mm-hmm.
But we know from him specifically that he believed in this cause since the 20s.
Yeah.
So in this particular case, like, he would have joined the party, I'm about as sure as you can get. If he was in Germany before the membership stop, he would have joined the party. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't, so he couldn't. And that was lucky for him, because then after the war, he was deemed to be just a bandwagoner.
Okay.
And he could return to academic life more or less without any issue.
So in
48, he got back to a university position. In 1950, he became a professor. In 1957, he became a professor in Vienna until 1971.
Okay.
So he had a good 23 years of academic career after the war that probably he wouldn't have had if he had been in Germany at the wrong time. Mm-hmm.
To play devil's advocate, and I guess, you know, I It's a bit shit because I have to like try and choose my words because I'm trying to take the sides to argue for something that I don't really believe in, but I guess it's kind of what I have to do. You said that he wrote the CV kind of on his CV. Was that like a literal CV that he mentioned that he supported Hitler's cause was in 1920s? More thinking like, could that just be a case of, you know, fluffing your CV up to support the guy who you think's going well? So I'm just gonna add this in there, as a lot of people do, and just go, you know, this is what I need to say to get the job, to get the role, rather than I believe, I'm sure there are a bunch of people listening to this, not specifically in this case, but have added things into their CV because they're like, I know this is going to suit the job.
Seems unlikely to me.
Okay.
He had the right friends. He was I think this was the job in Munich he got in 1938, where the director of the institute suggested that he would get the job, and he was appointed by Himmler. Which, if you get appointed by Himmler, you're you know, good with the Nazis.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't think he needed to fluff his CV in this way.
Okay.
I mean, technically it's possible, but I don't see. And I mean, it times out he was in Vienna in the 20s. Hitler came from Austria and started his career, you know, in those regions as well. So it would be weird to make this up.
Yeah.
Then again, it would be easy to make it up because it's possible, but it's, mm-hmm. No, I don't see him making this up to make a career for himself.
No, I was just curious whether that could be part of it.
It's been argued afterwards that, you know, no, he just did that too.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like he's pretty deeply rooted in the Nazi Party, quite clearly believes in this. So then when it comes to his research on Norse mythology, or Nordic mythology, whichever you want to call it, is it so that, I guess I have a, I, I'm bringing, my mind's working at 100 mile an hour trying to split these questions into two. One is, when scholars like this are researching Nordic mythology on behalf of the Nazi Party, or at least being involved in that, are they doing it from a propaganda perspective where they're trying to find things in Nordic mythology to then link them back to this kind of group of people that they can then promote? Or is it just that he had an interest in this stuff, and it just so happened that he was part of the Nazi Party? Did that make sense?
It does make sense. I think it's hard to answer the question.
Okay.
I mean, it's in the back of my mind throughout the project, which is ongoing, so I don't have
I guess that kind of leans into whether you can believe and trust this work or not.
Yeah, I think to an extent, maybe Nazism even was shaped by what he wrote. Because, I mean, this guy, was it his main work, or his most influential work, was on the Männerbünde, if that rings a bell, the cultic secret male bands that supposedly were part of Germanic peoples.
Mm-hmm.
Where he wrote this in the late 20s, early 30s. I think it came out in 31 as a book. So at this time, he had already been part of this Sturmabteilung and part of this male group that was very martial and very, yay, we're all men and being manly together, and you had to probably go through some sort of initiation because that's not uncommon. Mm-hmm. And to then sort of legitimize that or be inspired by it to write your big idea of how this was then supposedly the same case 2,000 years ago. By which you then rationalize that the rest of Germany or the Germanic speaking people can continue to do this martial type of manly groups as sort of interconnected. His big thing was behind this, it was the Germanic continuity problem, I think he called it. Can you use sources from 2,000 years ago to talk about younger material? He says yes. So if you read Tacitus about Germanic peoples, so this dates from the year 93, we can relate that to Eddic poetry from, well, do we usually say 1270? Or at least that's when we have the earliest source, but okay, let's date Eddic poetry back to the year 900. That's still 800 plus years of difference. Plus, one thing is in Iceland, the other thing is somewhere in the Rhine area.
Mm-hmm.
For Höffler, that's no problem. He says, no, these are Germanic peoples, and it's the same spirit of the Germanic peoples to do this kind of stuff. So it's very, yay, we're men, and we're being martial, and we're doing secret initiations. And you can see that in Tacitus when he talks about, what are these guys called? The guys that paint themselves black and walk around with spears and a very heirloom kind of stuff. And we can then see that in the Einherjar, and then we can see that in the German, like the medieval guilds, I think, like, or the Hansa League, that kind of stuff. And then we can still see that in, for example, the SS. And so he ties that together in 1800 years of Germans being German.
Mm-hmm. That seems quite propagandary, as to say, kind of, you know, the SS we have today is the same as all these different warrior groups throughout history, and, you know, that's where we're tough, and there's this, I guess, kind of lineage to it, and we're on the, I don't know, it's that whole idea of looking back in history at these groups of warrior men and kind of wanting to attach yourself to in a positive fashion.
So I'm just looking this up right now. I don't know why I haven't done this before, but so the SS started in 34, I think, which means that the SS started after Höffler wrote his big work on the Männerbund. So he inspired the existence of the SS with his work. I mean, it's not unlikely. So it's there might be a bit of a chicken and egg answer to your question.
I feel like we're in real time seeing you progress with your PhD here, that you just had this moment of kind of realization. Oh, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, the Sturmabteilung was already there, but Himmler's SS seems to be younger. So that's interesting. I need to look into that.
Okay, well, I want a credit in the PhD thesis, just a little. Right. Just put little my name notes in there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't care. It could be the smallest little thing ever, but I would. It would make me very happy.
I can make that happen, probably. I mean, this podcast is shaping my life to some extent. It's
we actually didn't mention it at the start of the show, and just a little tangent. All the work you do behind the scenes, for anybody who doesn't know or doesn't realize, all the amazing guests we've had on in the last How long have you been doing it now?
Started September last year.
So yeah, at least over a year. So all the guests we've had on the last 14 months have all been down to Bob reaching out to people, messaging people endlessly, emailing, replying, researching. So all the guests we've had on that time is just Bob's hard work behind the scenes, very much kind of on his own, just doing it for the love of the podcast. And I, you know, I appreciate, I'm sure everybody else appreciates it very much. It's helped the podcast kind of keep, not only keep going, but also just reach out to people that I certainly would never have known to message. You know, you're always finding new people in different areas that I guess, because obviously I'm not involved in this stuff, as we've decided it's called, you know, I kind of only see certain bits and get guest recommendations from fans and from listeners. Whereas because you're really kind of in there, you know, people who really do fit certain topics, and I've certainly enjoyed talking to these people that you've just gone, oh, this person fits this, talk to them. So I guess on behalf of everybody, to throw a little appreciation your way for the work you do. And, you know, I very much do appreciate it. All right, back to the topic before we get.
I'm here to talk about the booking as well. It's part of what I do. So I thought it would be very easy because, you know, I already know half these people. And if not, I know where to find them. It's nice for me to be able to network, you know, reaching out. Hopefully they remember my name and they think nicely of me afterwards. Like, oh, I had a nice experience talking with Dan. So Bob is probably a great guy. I should hire him for.
Don't put that pressure on me.
Oh, it's on.
They're judging you based on how they talk with me. Okay, I hope that so that goes
in your best behavior.
I do try.
Yeah.
I do try.
But yeah, so we had so many potential guests that never replied or that aren't available. Talking about, you know, we dig up new stuff every other day. We've had a few in the last 3 months, I think, where a groundbreaking, was it a ship find somewhere? And then they reinterpreted the Yelling Stone, and there was the big gold treasure hoard near Stavanger. Mm-hmm. And I reach out to all these people and they're like, you know, crickets.
Yeah. That's got to be frustrating.
Or they're busy, or their boss tells them that they're not allowed to do podcasts right now.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a very big double name coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Am I allowed to say that yet?
You can say.
This will be very cool. I think also I'm going to be a guest host on that episode.
Yeah.
I talked to Matthias about that before. We will have Raymond and Sarah Rowe of WWE fame join us on December 30th.
Mm-hmm. I know for you in particular, you know, you're a big fan of wrestling, so I know that's going to be a lot of fun. So yeah, absolutely, come and guess.
And this has been, was it Genevieve reached out? Genevieve Gornicek, a longtime listener and a former guest, said that, you know, I'm in the reenactment group with Raymond and Sarah. If you want them on the podcast, I can ask. I was like, yes, please. But this was like in January or February.
Yeah.
Very early February. So this has been a long time in the making.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's without banging too much on into like the Patreon and supporting like behind the scenes, there are so much, or there is, terrible English, there is so much that goes on behind the scenes that people don't necessarily see. Obviously the work you do, there's the whole social media side of things, there's the editing. So as I do bang on about it a lot about, you know, it's £3 a month, 10p a day. Please just, it does help us keep going and kind of just reached out to these people and getting these bigger guests on. So a midway plug, I guess, if you can pop over to Patreon, it's patreon.com/NordicMythologyPodcast. You know, there are a bunch of stuff and we are working on moving stuff around to get that reliability on those. I don't know if rewards are the right word, but the whatever we offer, we're working on the consistency of getting them there every single time so people are getting what they're meant to get. And yeah, we've got some big plans for the new year. I think it's exciting. Something we can't talk about yet.
It's true. But yeah, everyone sign up and then make sure that when I'm done with the PhD in 2 years, 2.5 years, that I can get a job as a booker for Nordic Mythology where they can actually pay me.
Now, yeah, that's the thing. Like that would be the dream. Like I would love to have this whole ecosystem around this where we could just hire a bunch of people who are awesome at what they do and just pay them to do it. Because at the moment, you know, like this is, I don't know if this class is a passion project because there are obviously things that it ties into the business that I do. There are a bunch of things that kind of can link to that. But for the most part, you know, I've never taken a penny from the Patreon. It's helped to pay for new equipment, but it goes towards like the editing, trying to advertise, and you know, those the behind the scenes things. So it really does all just kind of get invested back in, and it does. It's the only reason that the podcast is able to even keep existing is because people support it. So that's why we do push it so much. So as much as it does get tiresome sometimes, you know, it is a necessity. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a podcast without it. So should we get back to the...
Yeah, let's talk about Nazis again. That was fun.
Yeah. So yeah, I am intrigued by this duality of trying to figure out what we can trust, what we can't trust, because particularly in the case of what we were just talking about, you know, you have somebody who is very much an active Nazi, or so it seems. And they've clearly done some research. Now, it would make sense that not all of that is going to be completely tarnished by the fact that they're in the National Socialist Party. So how do we separate, and can we separate?
That is a very good question. That's, I guess, the key to my project. And I think that the traces I mentioned before hopefully give me a way to do this. So if I can find those traces of the publication in Hitler times, that at least gives us something to look for. Because, yeah, you're right. You can't, I mean, you could probably make up everything that you want, but then you wouldn't be taken seriously in academic circles at all. And the weird part about these guys is that they were rehabilitated and were able to be at the highest levels in their field. Like I said, Höffler from like 1950 to 1971 was a professor. The Dutch guy never got a professorship anymore. But he retired in 55, and then he really started publishing again. So this Altgermanische Religionsgeschichte, as you pronounce so well.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That came out in 56, 57. And he had a sort of a second life as a scholar. He became honorary life member of the Viking Society for Northern Research in England. He was invited to be an O'Donnell lecturer at Oxford University in 1963. So he was back at the top, basically. And after he died, he was called the foremost scholar of Germanic religion of his time. Something along those lines, at least. So he did something right.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, what snuck in there somehow?
Yeah.
And also to go back to your question from earlier, can't remember how you phrased it, but the answer is that for this guy, so the Dutch one, Jan de Vries, when he was in camp prison after the war, he wrote a diary or a journal, and it's framed as letters to his wife. And I'm not completely sure if they were sent as letters or if this is like Dear Diary, but you know, name of his wife. But in one of these entries, he says, you know that I never was very political in my life. I never joined any party. It seemed like he barely voted. Like he was very not involved with politics. But he says, I always felt I contributed to the politics of my time through my work. Which is one of the lines where I was like, okay, there's more to this guy than Terry Gunnell seemed to say. There is a PhD project here. So this is where it's like, okay, there is politics in his work. How do we find it? But we need to try.
But could it be, again, I don't know if this is me trying to look for the best in people. Is there, or even maybe not even with just these two, I guess, case subjects, do we ever see where people are trying to use, I don't know, almost through their research, persuade people in the other direction very subtly? So as you said, like there is politics in his work, maybe in a very subtle way, kind of quote unquote on the good side of things, just trying to maybe go against the party. And does that make sense? Does that make sense in kind of like?
It seems unlikely that he would go against the party if the party is the National Socialist Party.
Yeah, but I was meaning like in general, like from that time, are there any cases where people are through their research, maybe just trying to edge people away from it while maybe being a member, but just through maybe hate subliminal messages within the work.
It's a good question. I don't know. You'd hope so.
You would, because you would. I guess you would think there. You know, there are a bunch of people who were actively, you know, part of the party and believed in it. But there must obviously, as we mentioned earlier, there are a bunch of people who joined because they had to. So you would kind of think that maybe their work would try and be as accurate as possible, or possibly even the other way, and try and use it to move people away from that.
I mean, it's possible. It's sort of the opposite of what I'm trying to find. So I'm not actively looking for it.
Yeah.
But I mean, that would actually be a very interesting project to see. Yeah, what someone here said, resistance within the ranks.
Yeah. I've just sealed you another 3 years at the university.
Yeah, maybe. I think postdocs are usually shorter, but I mean, it's definitely something to look into. But yeah, for now, I think finding the Nazis within the ranks, trying to act like they're purely academic researchers, are more my thing right now.
Yeah. One question that's burning, I guess, is the one I forgot his name. The one from, did you say from Germany, who became a professor after the fact, had 20 odd years as a professor after the war. What was his name again?
Höfler. But he's Austrian.
Austrian, sorry.
So we can't actually blame the Germans for everything.
So With Hoefler, do you see a distinct difference between his academic research post-war versus in the war, or is there a continuity kind of throughout? Because I guess that would be a giant tell, wouldn't it, if as soon as the war ended, or at least kind of there and thereafter, if his work changed and became a certain direction, maybe there was a reason it was influenced by that. That's what was influenced by the party.
So far, I haven't looked at his work so much. I just finished transcribing all the letters because they're mostly handwritten German. So it took some time to go through all that. There's actually a very nice software that you can use for this these days.
And has that never been done by anybody before?
What, transcribing these letters?
Yeah.
No.
I just assume like every letter ever has been. Yeah.
Nope. No,
that's gonna be kind of exciting to be the first person to do it.
It's fun in a way, frustrating in another way.
Okay.
So the way I tackled this, first I had read the Jan de Vries material, so the Dutch guy. His camp journals were handwritten in Dutch, but that made me familiar with the way he writes. You know, his hand. So then the letters from him to Otto Hoefler are in the same hand, but it's in German. Now, my German is not fluent, but I can get by. And it was definitely enough with already knowing the handwriting to transcribe like 99% of those letters.
Mm-hmm.
And then the letters by Hoefler to de Vries were a bit more challenging. Quite more challenging, but like I said, there's software for this called Transcribus that is they call it handwritten text recognition software, which is I guess the equivalent to OCR, optical character recognition. Mm-hmm. So you just have the scan of the text, and then you do a layout analysis so it sees where the lines are. And then after that, you do handwritten text recognition, and it sees that on those lines, this is what it says.
Oh, wow.
So someone trained this. I guess it's artificial intelligence in some way. Someone trained this, or probably a whole team trained this, in what they call the German Giant 1, which is trained on handwritten text from, what is it, the 1600s to today. And it has a, what was it, character error rate of 9.8%, which means that about 92 out of 100 characters are correct in their analysis. And you can train this for your own hand as well. So I trained this AI, I guess, to read Otto Hoefler's handwriting. So you need to feed it corrected text, and then after a while, it knows exactly what he wrote, and so you can just feed it more letters, and then it's super interesting because and it developed very fast, because I remember looking into this as I first developed the PhD project, and then it seemed like the only way to really recognize handwriting is through a touchpad, so the way you would use it on your phone or tablet, where it can read your handwriting and put it into words, into typed words, but it wasn't good at seeing it from a photo.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Because there's a lot of motion in your handwriting that is sort of disappears when it's just a flat file, just a flat picture.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And somehow they managed to train this stuff to learn how characters look and how they look in different positions in the word, because a word initial S is different than a word final S in most cases.
Yeah.
It's amazing. People that do this software stuff, they blow my mind.
Yeah. So that has to make your life so much easier. But then, you know, it's fascinating to see where we're going to go in 5 years. And I know a lot of people have very negative things to say about AI, but in cases like this, it can really help, hopefully, lighten your load, but then help us make advancements in like these gaps in history.
Yeah, so I was able to train it to have a 2.2% character error rate. Wow. So it only has 2.2 characters wrong out of 100. So that is definitely very helpful. I don't know if this is technically AI or if it's machine learning or another term.
Okay, but, yeah.
Software, computery stuff, that's not my field, but it's very helpful. And we're always, what's the word? Pushed, I guess, to do digital humanities in the humanities. So we need to be more digital somehow. So actually using the software is good for me. Good for the university. Showing that, yeah, we are with the times because we use software somehow. I'm pretty sure I got away from the original question again, but looking at these letters, why are we looking at these letters?
So,
no. Just as we're going to edit this out. So.
I guess we're close to an hour and a half, so we probably should start trying to wrap it up somewhat into a neat, tidy bow. So I guess how, or the point you're at now, what do you think when it comes to their work? Can we differentiate and find some really accurate pieces that we can then objectively take and learn from and other scholars can use? Or is it leaning towards like we need to kind of start again, I guess? Or just disregard it in general?
I mean, I have good hope that the comparison between those two books, the 43 version and the 64 version, that it gives us something to work with, and to then hopefully use that to look at his material from that time. I mean, ideally, we find a smoking gun or multiple. And just be able to trace that. So, yeah, okay, this is a smoking gun. And then, I don't know, you open up. You know, Matthias might have an article somewhere where he repeats something that has been common knowledge for the last 50 years, where we can say, like, actually, this is sneakily put in there at some point. Where we just don't know. I mean, there's too much in scholarly literature that isn't properly cited. Also because otherwise the entire book would be a footnote and you couldn't really get through the text. But it makes it difficult to see like where something comes from. But it is possible. So that would be a fun project to go through various things. Of course, it would be a very good thing to start all over again, but I don't think we can, because we kind of have to decide that worldwide, almost, to say, like, okay, we need to start over. And I mean, it's not just these Nazis that we need to get over, because there was the whole national romanticism before that, which is also problematic in very many ways. And in that sense, the guys I'm working with or looking at are also a product of their time and influenced by, I don't know, let's say the Brothers Grimm, who were very much into building the German nation in opposition to the French nation and other nations and saying, oh, look how great Germany is. And look, we also have mythology, because Germany doesn't have mythology. Not really. They have fairy tales, but they don't have mythology like the Greeks do or the Romans do or the Icelanders do. And then they said, yeah, but look at at this Edda with all this mythology that's German, and we know from language that Icelandic is related to German, and therefore their mythology is our mythology. Look, we have German mythology.
Okay. Yeah.
And that sort of trickled down into now, where we can still see basically the same argument. And the reason why we're sitting here, more or less, is because people keep bringing it up.
They do. It is a fascinating time period that, you know, I don't know, I feel like you keep expecting it, not you particularly, but in general, people expect this to kind of get boring or people to get fed up with Vikings and, you know, Norse mythology, but it just doesn't seem to be going anywhere. It's as fascinating as it always has been. And that could be down to the fact that we know so little. We know so much, I guess, through sources, but then those sources can be argued against or questioned, and they're written by Christians, and there's all this stuff that makes it so ambiguous that it just keeps making it more and more fascinating, and I guess, and coupled with the fact that it is a time period that's so interesting and is full of these people who were warriors and doing all this cool stuff, however you look at it, around Europe and conquering stuff, and it's just, I don't know.
That in itself is a very interesting point, that why this fascination with the warriors? Why are they so fascinating? Why don't we care about farmers? I mean, there are people that care about farmers.
It's just more glamorous, isn't it?
You wouldn't watch a 2.5-hour movie about a farmer in Iron Age Scandinavia that dies of dysentery or something.
But that's it. I think it's, it makes just sense. It's our culture, isn't it? The culture we live in at the minute, it's this. It's very violence based when you look at movies, games. We're fascinated by by violence, by a warrior kind of thing. It's exciting. It's who's the best, who's the, you know, it's just, I don't know. It is. And I find it fascinating. You know, I love, I'm a big lover of like violent movies. I don't really play games too much anymore, but I am kind of into that stuff. So I do get it. And it does lean into the whole kind of, whatever you think of it as, like the man side of things. I'm sure men find it quite fun to enjoy this stuff. And you're engaging with the chat.
Yeah. Someone said Little House on the Fjord, and that's amazing.
Yeah.
And yeah, because of capitalism, that is also very true. I mean, it's interesting. In I've been playing a lot of Valheim recently. I finally had the time when I got sick, and it stuck around. But part of that is you're just building a little homestead, I guess.
Yeah, and
just walking around the meadows and exploring, and so you don't even have to do all the missions or do it. Apparently there's a whole bunch of people that just build their mansions.
I'm sure.
Enjoy themselves farming and doing stuff and just getting away from life. So there is a market for the non-violent, non-martial aspect of a Viking Age as well. And I mean, you see it, obviously, it's talked about here a lot, and everyone brings it up, like, oh, you know, Vikings weren't just raping and pillaging across the lands. They were also, although then you get into the discussion, is a Viking also just a farmer or not? But they were probably part-time farmers. So, you know, there could be more focus on the farming part of things, or I don't know, wood chopping or other stuff that they would do in Scandinavia.
No one's wanting to watch that unless it's that Thorin Bradley guy. Because he, I don't know if you've seen him, the guy on TikTok, I'm sure he's called Thorin. I think it's Thorin Bradley. He has like millions of followers who just watch him chop logs. And he knows what he's doing. It's very sexual. He's a good looking guy. But yeah, people love watching him just chop wood, I guess.
I think I've seen a video of Eddie Hall watching him do that stuff.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe. Like I say, he's got tons and tons of followers. So maybe if you had a handsome man doing it in a movie, it would be popular. I don't know. It's just a thing, isn't it? I don't know. Violence is cool. It is just cool. I don't know how to explain it. It is, and maybe that's because we've been taught that over years of just movies, TV shows, and it's just kind of what we like. And morbid curiosity is a thing, isn't it? Like, it is kind of a human trait of, ooh, what's this?
But is it? Or is it because you do it? Yeah. I mean, there's a thing here in Norway, at least. I don't know if it's Scandinavia wide. They call it slow TV. And so they mount a camera on the front of a cruise ship or a train, and then it's just 7 hours of driving from Oslo to Bergen on this train track.
That sounds horrendous for
me.
Or
the boat from Oslo to Denmark, which is, I think, 16 hours, and nothing really happens. It's just a boat sailing through Oslo Fjord and then over a sea, and it was a big thing. I don't know if it's still around, but it was
maybe quite calming.
It was very, very soothing. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to be all violence and Vikings. It could just be, we should make a movie. There's 2 hours of someone farming.
No one's going to watch it. We want the violence is cool. I don't care what anyone says. It just is. I don't care how I came to this. I don't, whatever indoctrination it took me through my life to get me to this point.
No. You can do the alternative universe where Ragnar actually just became a farmer in England after he settled down. He got his little land. And then Ragnar Lothbrok just farms for the rest of his life.
Yeah. Okay. We can go with that.
We can get Travis to do that, right?
Maybe, who knows? All right, let's wrap this up, Bob, and then we will take some questions and do a little bonus episode. So, you know, it's been fun. I enjoy these conversations of kind of like hypotheticals of, well, not, it's not hypotheticals, like you are going to figure out the difference between these. But I like this idea of being able to, it's almost that question that you see all the time of separating the art from the artist. And I do find that fascinating of whether you can really do that or whether it's always going to have some sort of lasting effect on it. Mm-hmm. And that's effectively kind of what you're trying to do.
Yeah. But I guess in this case, it's like I'm going to sift through the lyrics and see if there's sneaky Nazi shit in there.
Okay, yeah.
Whereas with most artists, well, at least if it's visual arts, it's probably a bit trickier to see. Like, ooh, a painting of a mountain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do we care if the guy was a Nazi or not?
Yeah.
We don't have to buy it, but you can find it a pretty picture. Mm-hmm. But if it's a mountain that says something master race, I would probably think again.
Yeah, for sure. For sure, absolutely. Yeah, okay, so let's wrap this up. Let's do the Q&A. As to reiterate earlier, you know, I appreciate everything you do on the show. It's, you know, it really does make things go smooth, lets us get guests that we would never usually find. So, you know, I do have to solemnly thank you for the work you do. I do very much appreciate it, and I'm sure everybody listening does. And I wish you all the best with your PhD project as well.
Thank you.
Also, where can people follow you? I know you have your Instagrams.
I have my Instagram at Norse Folks. Like I said last time, it's not Nordic Folks, but Matthias said it's okay. I can use Norse Folks if I want to. Folks is with a F-O-L-X.
Yeah. Wonderful.
For good reasons.
Yeah, so if you want to follow the podcast, it's just Nordic Mythology Podcast across the board on all the different social medias. If you want to I always forget to mention this, if you want to watch the show, if you want to see mine and Bob's pretty faces and all the previous guests, we have a YouTube channel, just Nordic Mythology Podcast. And Rocco does appear a lot. There's always a point in the episode where he's like, I'm needy now. I'm going to come and sit on my knee. So if you want to have that visual element, because sometimes there are people, guests hold things up, they show things. If you want that, all our episodes are on YouTube. Please hit the little subscribe button. It just helps us reach new people, helps YouTube think we're popular. And then if you want to follow me, it's Daniel_Farrand1. And the business is at Horns of Odin. Yeah. And as always, I appreciate everybody that listens, likes, shares, comments, and the supports on Patreon. I do very much appreciate it. This is very much a love of mine to do the podcast, and I'm very grateful to have been doing it for so long. So yeah, let's wrap this up, Bob.